Call to order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is February 8th, 2012, and we are convened for the purposes of public hearing and possible work session on a variety of bills. To give the committee and the public a roadmap of my intentions, we will hear SM 201 first, then we will go to SB 1535, then to SB 1537, then we will go to SB 1548, and we will not be doing anything with SB 1589. So if you are here for SB 1589, you may feel free to go. We will, however, be doing a hearing, an informational hearing, on February 27th on the topic of price agreements and indefinite quantity contracts, and those public agencies that engage in these. We would like you to come and be prepared to testify on February 27th to the particular firms who are getting that those kinds of contracts and the amounts of those contracts. And we want the specific information on the names of the firms and the dollar amounts for the last 3 years. That's SB 1589. We will not be doing that. Then we will go to SB 1518, and then to SB 1552 and SB 1564. All right. So that being said, colleagues, glad you're all here, and I will open a public hearing on SM 201. Jan, would you like to tee it up for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate Memorial 201, it urges Congress to enact and for the President to sign the Trade Reform, Accountability, Development, and Employment Act, known as the Trade Act of 2009. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
All right. Do we have the Senate sheet? Could we please bring up Greg Pellison, Rob Rennie, and Elizabeth Swagger. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Greg Pallison, and I am the Vice President of the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers Union, known as the AWPPW. We're affiliated with United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, the UBC, and I'm an officer of both the AWPPW and the UBC. I'm here today, and I have written testimony I'll submit, but to speak in favor of Memorial 201. Oregon, along with most all nations or states in the nation, continue to see businesses shutters as a direct result of the failed U.S. trade policies. One recent example, which I know we've all have been dealing with, was the closure of the Blue Heron Mill, where 175 good-paying jobs were permanently eliminated. So gone is the major business and tax revenue for the city. And that ripple effect is felt certainly by more than 175. Blue Heron was a cornerstone of Oregon City for over 100 years, and it produced some of the greenest and finest quality recycled paper. And to do so, it relied heavily on recovered waste paper collected from recycling bins throughout Oregon. In 2001, Congress voted to allow China into the World Trade Organization. And not too long after, the exports to China began to climb. And while the overall exports of paper and other products plummeted, China now produces more paper products than anybody in the world. And the recovered waste paper is now one of America's single largest paper exports. And the price of waste paper has gone through the roof. And these Chinese companies can afford to pay more, way more than a lot of the mills on the West Coast. And, you know, so many mills end up not surviving. And like so many that don't survive, what a lot of people I think don't understand is the mill equipment will be dismantled and has been dismantled there, just like at almost all locations. And that equipment ends up being sent overseas. Much of it goes to China, but other countries, and is reassembled and brought back online, producing the same products that were once made here in the U.S. On May 27, 2010, those workers at Blue Heron were certified for the by the Department of Labor on the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, the TAA. And this is not the first time that the location had, had been certified for TAA. And this workforce has taken pay cuts previously, pay and benefit cuts, along with a lot of other locations that have, this has happened on. So, you know, the AWPPW, we've continually have tried to work with Congress to change our policies, and it's truly failed policies. We support the Trade Reform Accountability Development Act. The Trade Act would create consistent labor environmental standards. You know, some in Congress say the bill's too prescriptive, but the solution instead has been to promote business as usual trade policies that will expand the problems with the existing ones. And, you know, we're facing the same thing right now in SB Newsprint in Newburgh, Oregon. And again, that mill, they filed bankruptcy. Those workers have been previously certified for TAA benefits. And it's hard to say what the outcome of that mill will be. And the TAA program has been valuable for some, but it's hard to not be cynical about it. In Oregon and Washington, over 116,000 people have qualified for NAFTA or TAA benefits since 1994. And it's, you know, as we track people, we know of no one that has gone on to do a job that pays as much or the benefits have been as well. And many of them end up in low-paying, with all due respect to those who are in the retail business, but low-paying jobs in retail, selling the very same products that were they once made. And, you know, you'll hear people say that our trade policies create jobs, and yes, they're created, but they fail to look at the rest of the math equation. Jobs created plus or minus jobs lost. And more times than not, the benefits for these new jobs do pay less than they are in the manufacturing business. You know, along with the staggering trade deficit, you know, you don't hear a lot of politicians talk about the trade deficit. They'll talk about our national deficit. But the trade deficit is directly responsible for our national deficit. You know, the federal government, if you look at it, is broke. Our states are broke, our counties are broke, and we no longer have the tax base that's required for our infrastructure, for money or schools or basic services. And this is all taking place while we're still one of the richest nations in the world. And it's quite ironic, I think, for state representatives to try to figure out how to create new jobs while our congressional representatives continue to support and pass trade agreements that virtually make it impossible for the states to succeed. Some politicians believe that the answer to our deficits is for working families to take pay cuts, pay more for health insurance, reduce or eliminate pensions, or deregulate safety and environmental laws, and deregulate banking. It's our trade policies that are destroying our economy piece by piece, and our members of Congress are directly responsible. We must change our trade policy, so I ask for your support of the Senate Memorial 201. You know, as I said, I'll end with, you know, when I talk to a lot of people, they talk about the federal deficit. But look at and how big federal government has grown. But look at the states. Virtually every state in the nation is broke. And I would ask, have the states' governments, have you all grown so huge you've consumed our tax dollars? And the answer is no. We've lost our tax base. We've lost our jobs. And that's truly the problem. We have to have and must have a new economic and trade policy. I'll answer any questions if you have, and thank you very much.
All right. So good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Elizabeth Swagger, and I'm the Assistant Director of Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, a statewide coalition of labor, environmental, human rights organizations working together to promote U.S. trade policy and to improve U.S. trade policy. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Memorial 201 and, by extension, a critical piece of trade reform legislation called the Trade Act. The Trade Reform Accountability Development and Employment Act is supported by more than 550 diverse organizations in the country that together represent tens of millions of Americans. These organizations recognize that while trade always has been and always will be a fundamental part of our economy, the rules that govern trade are severely flawed and must be amended. This is an issue of real significance to the Oregon State Legislature. Today's trade policies can be literally thousands of pages long and contain provisions on public procurement, public services, and investor rights that affect a wide range of state and local policy authority. Let me give just three examples. First off, past trade deals include provisions that allow U.S. laws, regulations, and even court decisions to be challenged as barriers to international trade in international tribunals under the auspices of the World Trade Organization, World Bank, and the United Nations. Under the WTO, the U.S. has lost over 90% of the 65 cases brought against it, curtailing regulations under the Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act, and Marine Mammal Protection Act, and many other U.S. laws. The Trade Act begins to address this by ensuring that foreign investors don't get greater rights than American businesses and citizens, and by plainly stating that U.S. laws and regulations are applied evenly to foreign and domestic businesses and investments and aren't subject to challenge in international tribunals. Secondly, a number of past trade deals have attempted to limit measures designed to keep taxpayer dollars curtailing in local economies through buy local preferences. The Trade Act ensures that future trade pacts will not constrain the Oregon legislature's decision on how to spend taxpayer dollars. Third, some past trade deals contain provisions that constrain service industry regulations. Recently, the United States has lost a case in the World Trade Organization under its entertainment services provisions and was forced to shell out millions of dollars in taxpayer funds just to maintain the state's internet gambling regulations. The Trade Act ensures that future trade pacts will not force deregulation or privatization of services. It leaves those decisions in the hands of elected bodies. Let me say just once again, in conclusion, that trade is crucially important to the state's economy, and that's why it's so important that we get the rules governing international trade right. As the National Conference of State Legislatures' current policy on free trade and federalism states, it's the job of elected legislators, not international tribunals, to decide when regulations are necessary. Senate Memorial 201 is a reaffirmation of that principle, and we urge you to support it. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Rob Rennie. I work at the Newburgh Mill, SP Newsprint in Newburgh, Oregon. I've been there for 35 years. I've seen a lot of good times and some bad times. Nothing compares with the recent past, though. In 2009, we were curtailed for 6 months with the workforce being laid off during that period of time. When we came back up, we came back up as a one-machine mill with 50 people permanently laid off, or indefinitely at least. It's a very emotional experience to go through. As a member of the Union Executive Board, Standing Committee member, to try to go out, we did a lot of things for our membership, but nothing compares with having a full-time job. The trade acts have affected us immensely in furnished costs, our recycled product that comes in. Those things are just over the top expensive now. It's prohibitive almost in some cases, such as what happened with Blue Heron. On a local front, I would say that the membership has done whatever we could do. We've worked with the company. We gave up in 2010, we gave up 19% in wages to try to be a part of the fix. But the bottom line on it is that with the escalating costs because of the China trade agreements, it really hasn't been enough. We find ourselves in bankruptcy today. We have a very insecure future, if you will. We qualified for Trade Act benefits in 2009 during our curtailment period. Today I'm here speaking. I have five brothers in the back of the room here. I'm just asking you to please support this Trade Act reform. It is amazing how detrimental it's been to our particular industry and the nation as a whole. So thank you.
Thank you very much for coming to tell your story. Any questions for this panel, colleagues? Thank you very much. Bill Cluding and Ron Moulton.
Good morning. My name is Ron Milton, and I was one of the 175 employees who lost their job at the end of February last year from Blue Heron Paper. That closure was a direct result of the spiking of the cost of recycled paper as it as the Chinese drew down the local availability there. Most of the number of fellow employees who lost their jobs in February are still looking for employment. Those who have found jobs have found it at a significantly lower income rate, and many of them are facing the possibility of losing their homes, or at least a number of them are at this point. I personally, without the benefit of the Trade Act assistance, would almost certainly have lost my home by this time. And the machine that I worked on will most likely be making paper in competition with my my union brothers in the next few years. And I would just encourage you to consider this bill and to support it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, committee members. For the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's needed. I personally, in 2000, when my plant went down, I spent the next 3 years working with displaced workers, and I'll testify to the fact here, as I did in Washington, D.C., that out of the 2,000 people I worked with and documented information working with the state agencies, schools, and federal agencies on these displaced workers, 20% wound up finding equal employment or equal benefits out of these 2,000 workers. Over 1,000 of them just kind of fell through the cracks. We need fair trade, but we also need fair trade for our workers. We cannot afford to lose any more American workers. And I'll stop right there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. That's all the people we had signed up. Is anybody else interested in testifying on this?
Are we in a work session?
No, nope, public hearing. Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on SM-201 and open a work session on SM-201. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Memorial 201 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved SM-201 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there discussion?
Chair.
Senator George.
Colleagues, and yes, I want to kind of explain my position on this. I'll be voting no on this memorial. Here, let me kind of explain to you a little bit my perspective on this issue. My brother and I started a company in 1994. We do 98% export business. And our company has reinvested in our workers here, and we wanted to take our workers full-time year-round in the state of Oregon. And to do so, we signed a contract with a major company in a developing country in South America to import raw material into our plants here in Oregon, process it here, and export it to a European company. The only thing that would be happening in this country would not be the consumption of the product, but only the value added using our workers in a season that would keep our people employed year-round, allow us to add benefits. The regulatory hurdles we faced in trying to get the product into this country, trying to get through the FDA, the USDA, all of the regulatory mess, stalled us 6 weeks, which put the whole entire contract in jeopardy. In addition, all of the regulatory burdens we faced about having product coming in from another country to do value added here put us in a situation where it was almost impossible for us to actually conduct the contract. During that time, local government moved against our plant, saying that we didn't have the proper permits to go year-round, that we were only authorized to do a seasonal business. And in fact, yesterday I got an email from the county telling us that by February 24th they're going to shut us down because they don't see any reason for us to operate year-round. The fact is that it doesn't really bother me what I pay my employees. My employment costs are not my problem. It's the regulatory costs in this country that make it almost impossible for us to operate and be competitive. We have a choice. We have a choice to pick up our operation and move major portions of it to South America. I don't want to do that. I don't even have to afford to do that. My workers, I've actually had conversations with my workers about how many of them would be willing to move to South America to actually have full-time work. We would actually fly them back and forth between the two plants in South America so that we can actually operate. And I just find this ridiculous. And I look at the timber guys, and for those of you who are in the paper mill, I can't tell you how sympathetic I am. But the bottom line is that the problem we have with the timber industry is that we have, through regulation, shut down access to our forests so that people cannot get a supply of boards and pulp at a reasonable cost. And what we've done is we've taken unbelievably successful family wage jobs and shut them down in this country. When it comes down to it is that for years and years and years, we kept saying if you keep putting these regulations on business, they're not going to be able to afford to operate here. And then when it finally comes true, everybody says, oh, it's some kind of free trade problem. For those of us who do trade in an international market, we can compete. A lot of us can compete using American labor, paying a family wage job, and trying to provide benefits to our employees. That's not the problem. And the problem is that we need to take a good look at our regulatory systems. Why am I facing harassment? Why are my brother and I facing harassments from federal, state, and local jurisdictions to run a business that we've been operating in this location for 5 years? And at some point, all of these issues have to be discussed in a macro scale. And to think that telling somebody that we're going to put trade barriers to somebody who wants to do business overseas and wants to bring it back into this country, and we get into trade wars, just makes it more and more difficult for companies like us to be successful who do a lot of export. For folks that grow hazelnuts, there has never been a more high record price for hazelnuts ever paid in the history of the world. Hazelnuts and tree nuts generally are at the highest market because the world markets are open to us. And they're open to us, and we're able to compete. And what you'll see is all across this valley, people taking grass seed land, people taking land that otherwise, and putting in hazelnut trees. Because of the fact that our plants here in Oregon are so incredibly efficient and successful that we can compete in the world market. We are facing direct competition from countries like Turkey, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Chile, Brazil, and even China itself. And yet we're able to be successful. And what bothers me about all this is that what people think is that, oh, for some reason I can't compete because I got to pay my employees higher pay. No. The cost of doing business in this country is the fact that regulations, I have to have almost 2 full-time people doing nothing but deal with regulators. And to be perfectly honest with you, I'm sick and tired of it. And if they shut me down one more time, we will have to pack up our plant and move it out of this country. And it has nothing to do with our workers. It has nothing to do with anything else other than I have regulators who constantly want to shut our plant down, and I can't figure out why. And if those of you are interested in the email I got from the county yesterday and you want to see the threat that they're going to shut me down on February 25th, if I don't pay a bunch of additional fees and fines and all those things, I'm more than willing to share it with the committee. Bottom line is on this thing, this issue is complex. And for those of us who are export-based, our lifeblood is being able to trade with countries like China. And to give you an idea, China buys about 60% of all the tree nuts produced on the West Coast. It used to be 10 years ago that shipping to China was almost free because there were so many containers coming this way. This year, we couldn't find ships available of all of the product being shipped from the United States to China, meaning China was buying more product than they were sending us this year. And so all I have to say is that these issues are complex, and there's people on both sides. And I would say, especially those folks who are in the timber industry, it has been a perfect example of us shutting down our forests, not taking advantage of our natural resources to be competitive in the world market. And I apologize if this is one of these issues that really is emotional for me. But my business depends on foreign trade. And to think that my employees are going to have to move out of their country that they live in, that they are born in, to keep their jobs is just absolutely ridiculous to me. So I will be voting no. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? I'd like to say I appreciate Senator George's comments and certainly his passion when it comes to this. And I think that's exactly the type of debate that we should have in this country. And that is part of the reason why I think it's appropriate for the legislature to consider this memorial, because for the last 10, arguably 20 years, we've been living on a real estate, finance, and home construction bubble. And when that burst, we woke up to the fact that we've shipped most of our jobs overseas. Heck, even the bridges that we are building, for example, the Bay Bridge, we've been prohibited from using American steel to build them. And I think it's a very large reason why we are having such a difficult time breaking below 9 and even 8% on unemployment issues. So I do think that this will spur a discussion. It's not about this particular bill in the Trade Act. It's not about setting up tariffs. It's about making sure that environmental and labor standards are also taken into account in our trade agreements and not just investor standards, which is how investor rights, which is how our trade policies tend to work today. So I certainly appreciate Senator George's concern. I think it rightfully is a discussion that we should have on the Senate floor, and I look forward to moving it and having that discussion on the floor. I will also say that there are 9 Republican co-sponsors of this bill, and I believe 8 Democratic co-sponsors of the bill. Senator Boquist.
I wasn't going to comment for the sake of time, but since you decided to speak, Mr. Chair, I fully agree with Senator George in regard to the regulatory problems we face here in the U.S. I'm on the other side of the double-edged sword, which is the World Trade Organization. You know, I believe in free trade, but the fact of the matter is we don't have free trade. They get to make rules on their side that we have to abide by, you know, out there. And so it's kind of, you know, we've dulled one edge. You know, if we're going to have free trade, let's have free trade. If not, then let's make it fair. And so, but I fully agree with Senator George and the whole issues of regulatory, you know, we have problems here in Oregon we can fix. This, we're asking Congress to get off their butt and do something different, because they're failing in Washington, D.C. They're failing miserably. The economy is failing miserably. And frankly, D's and R's alike in Congress are to blame. So I'm willing to try just about anything at this point to get people back to work in the state of Oregon.
Will the clerk please call the roll?
Yes.
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Vice Chair George.
No.
Chair Shields.
Chair votes aye. The memorial passes, and I will be the carrier. I will close the work session on SM-201, and I will open a public hearing on SB-1535. Jan, can you tee it up for us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 1535 authorizes affordable housing covenants that are contained in a recorded master form instrument to be incorporated by reference in the short form instrument recorded for a real property transaction. There are no committee amendments before you. There is no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact on this bill.
Okay. We have Jesse signed up and Jill from Senator Dingfelder's office. Which one of you would like to go first?
I'll go first. Okay. Chair Shields and members of the committee, my name is Jill Gray, and I'm the legislative aide for Senator Dingfelder. I'm here with Jesse Beeson from Proud Ground, with whom we worked on this bill. And I'm here just to introduce the bill and explain a little bit about how we arrived at Senate Bill 1535, and then I will pass it off to Jesse. So as very brief background, in 2007, Senator Dingfelder introduced a bill regarding affordable housing covenants, and the covenant is just saying very basically that for an affordable home, when the homeowner moves or leaves, that that home goes to another lower moderate income Oregonian, and that way the home always stays in the affordable housing stock. And that bill passed, and about a year and a half ago or so, Proud Ground contacted us and said that they had an idea for legislation that somewhat builds on that the work we did with the covenant. And that idea for legislation is contained in Senate Bill 1535. So I was trying to think how to explain this bill in as basic terms as possible, because I admit recording of documents it's not always the most exciting thing, but here's my best shot at trying to explain it very succinctly. Affordable housing homes, like any home, has documents that need to be recorded, but those documents can frequently be longer and more complex than typical market rate homes. However, the affordable housing community knows that there have been some instances in Oregon when the documentation for an affordable housing home was not recorded, and probably even more instances when there were errors in the paperwork, because it can be very long and complex. With Senate Bill 1535, we want to encourage the recording of those affordable housing documents to make sure our investments in affordable housing are properly recorded in the public domain. To do that, this bill will allow the recording of a master form or a short form for affordable homes, and a master or short form will mean that the longer affordable housing document will need to be recorded just once, and then if anything happens, such as a transfer of the property, you can record a shorter form that will refer to the longer document, and you can do that multiple times if there are multiple transfers. And I realize even with that explanation, it can still be somewhat confusing to understand what the bill is about. So yesterday when I was putting my notes together, I was trying to think, how can I address this differently? And really, I think we all want to know, why is this bill important? Why do we need this bill? And I would say that first and foremost, it's because we want to protect the investments we've already made in affordable housing. Because of their length and complexity, there are times when affordable housing documents are not being recorded, and we want to encourage the exact opposite. We want to make sure that those documents are recorded so that we protect the time, energy, money that has already been invested in affordable housing. And I would say a secondary reason why it's important is that we want to help decrease the errors that can frequently occur because of the length and complexity, and hopefully with a short form, they are less prone to having those errors. Before I turn it over to Jesse, I just have a few last points to consider. And the first one is, we have received this question by several people. And the question is, how does this bill affect the document recording fee that the legislature passed in 2009 that is devoted to affordable housing? And the answer is that it doesn't. And I will leave it to Jesse to explain how that works. But I just wanted to make it clear that it does not affect the document recording fee. And the two last points are, Oregon law already allows a master short or a master form short form for, I believe it's trust deeds, but it doesn't expressly allow it for affordable housing documents. And lastly, there is no known opposition to this bill. And with that, I will turn it over to Jesse.
Day is young.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 1535. My name is Jesse Beeson. I'm the Executive Director of Proud Ground. Proud Ground is a nonprofit organization that helps low and moderate income families buy their first home in Multnomah and Washington counties. In 13 years, we've served more than 150 first-time home buyers. We join public agencies and other nonprofits that do so by using federal and local subsidy to invest in the long-term affordability of our homes, ensuring that generations of Oregonians have access to affordable home ownership. To protect that public subsidy, homeowners sign affordability agreements that are attached to the home. These affordability agreements are complex, and because they are executed every time a home is sold or a new home buyer buys a home, document and recording errors can occur easily. And sometimes organizations aren't recording these agreements at all. Errors and a lack of recording can put the public subsidy at risk. And in fact, though it was not with one of our homes, public subsidy was indeed lost when a home was foreclosed against the affordability agreement, which hadn't been recorded. Senate Bill 1535 is a simple fix that would solve this. With this bill, a long affordability agreement can be recorded just once for all home buyers under a program, and then a much shorter agreement for each specific home buyer is recorded that binds that short agreement to the long agreement. It ensures that affordability agreements remain consistent over time, ensuring that no homeowner is treated differently, that no costly mistake is made, and no public subsidy is lost when an agreement goes unrecorded. As Jill mentioned, Oregon already allows this master short form arrangement. We simply want to expand the kinds of documents that this arrangement can do so, and most importantly, this fix will have absolutely no impact on the recording fees that fund affordable housing. I urge and thank you for your support of Senate Bill 1535.
Questions for this bill? All right. Would anybody else like to testify on this bill? All right. That being said, this one is ready to go, colleagues. I will close the public hearing on SB 1535 and open a work session on SB 1535. Senator George? 1535.
Sorry. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1535 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved SB 1535 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Senator Dingfelder. Thank you. I just would like to thank the work of Jesse Beeson and his group, who has been doggedly efficient, and especially want to thank you for this great graphic, because we were sort of saying we really appreciate you dumbed it down for us, because you know we need this type of very very good explicit graphic. And but you've taken a fairly complicated issue and been able to distill it down in terms that the average person can understand about the need for this, because I know this is the second time around. Sometimes it takes a little while for it to sink in with us, and certainly appreciate your persistence and, of course, the work of my staff, who's been equally dogged on this. So thank you.
And my concern about the bill from last time is that I wanted to make sure that the intent of this was not to allow those that benefit from the document recording fee increase to avoid paying the document recording fee increase. And Jan, could you tell us what the Legislative Fiscal Office said about
the
bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. Both Legislative Fiscal Office and Legislative Revenue Office analyzed the bill. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the bill.
Okay. Good. Well, we are in work session. Is Senator George out in the hall? Do we know?
And Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I just wanted to add.
Senator Boquist.
No, I just wanted to add that certainly anything we can do to make sure to ensure affordable housing stays in affordable housing, since it's a huge issue for us, not just in Multnomah and Washington County, but obviously throughout the state, making sure that we have adequate and sufficient affordable housing for low and middle income Oregonians. So appreciate again the work that this organization has done.
Okay. If the clerk could call the roll, we'll let Senator Boquist vote later if necessary.
Senator Boquist.
Excused.
Senator Dingfelder.
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Vice Chair George.
Aye.
Chair Shields.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator Dingfelder, would you like to carry this?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dingfelder will be the carrier. I will close the work session on SB 1535 and open a public hearing on SB 1537. Jan, could you tee it up for us?
Hi, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 1537 prescribes a procedure and the form of notice for a cemetery authority to follow for the disposition of abandoned burial spaces. There are no committee amendments before you. There is no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact. A statement was issued on this bill.
All right. And we have two people signed up to testify, Randy Tucker and Tim Farrell.
Chair Randy Tucker, Metro.
Welcome to the Consumer and Cemetery Committee.
That's right. I hope, with your permission, I've brought up with me Paul Slamon, who's the director of our Metro's Parks and Environmental Services Department. That's the piece of Metro that operates our cemetery program. And what I'd like to do is turn it over to Paul for a minute to make some introductory comments. I will then talk about the bill itself, and then you know, be happy to entertain questions, obviously, and Tim is here as well. So is that okay? Great. Thanks.
Chair Shields, as Randy mentioned, I'm Paul Slamon. I work for Metro. I'm here to tell you why I think the Senate bill is important to us and our operations. I'll keep it as brief as possible. Metro operates 14 pioneer cemeteries, the majority of which were established in the late 1800s. A few predate statehood, and these cemeteries provide the community a place of quiet reflection, access to nature, and also burial places. We think these are community jewels, but we must keep operating them if they're going to continue serving the community. They're not museums. The reason why this bill helps us is we face a very common situation whereby the original purchasers of burial plots nor their descendants can be found by Metro, and we're not sure if they've been interred elsewhere or if they have other desires. This may not seem to be a problem, but it exerts pressure on the cemeteries to expand their boundaries or locate new facilities while we still have many unused spaces within the existing confines of the cemeteries. In our two most popular cemeteries, we've stopped selling burial spaces while we have a waiting list of folks that would like to purchase such burial spaces. We believe that this is the right thing to do, to not sell any additional spaces. However, we also suspect that the original purchasers nor their descendants have any interest in exercising their burial purchases in our cemeteries. As Randy will explain, the present law is very expensive and very outdated for cemeteries such as Metro's or any others across the state to reclaim those burial rights. So we've worked with the Cemetery Association of Oregon and others to create what we believe is an improved process that not only gives additional notice to the original purchasers and their descendants, but in effect makes these spaces available to other community members that might want to purchase them should they come back to the cemetery authority. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. You ought to have a sheet that says, please support SB 37 on it, and I think the protocol is you have to identify where those sheets come from, and just I'll point out that the very bottom on the back has my identifying information. I realized after I distributed that that's not the normal way. As you know, we've affectionately been calling this bill the zombie bill, but actually, even though there are plenty of puns that could be made about this, it's a serious issue, as Paul has explained. As Paul already described, we have a number of graves where we can't identify the owners, but this is true for cemeteries across Oregon as well. When we started talking about this issue last session, we learned that there's a broad interest in it among people that operate cemeteries. There's a burden to the cemetery owner, of course, of not being able to find the people that own the graves, but there's also, as Paul explained, there's a limit. It limits the availability of burial spaces to the community, and especially in our cemeteries, at least from our experience, there's a lot of demand and interest in those facilities, and we'd like to be able to make them available to the extent that's possible. There is an existing process for reclaiming a burial space, but it's a very convoluted and unwieldy process, and it's also only available in limited circumstances because it's based on the notion of nuisance, and it dates from the time when most cemeteries required the owner of a burial space to be responsible for the upkeep of that burial space. That's not universally true anymore, because that's the rationale for the existing process, it's only available in the circumstances where the owner is responsible for that. So this bill would provide a universal process that anybody could use. Bill before you also provides more protection to the existing owner of a burial space in that it provides a longer period of no contact before the process can be undertaken to reclaim the space. And it also provides higher levels of notice. It requires, in addition to what's written in the sheet that I've distributed, it also requires electronic mail and telephone if those are available, or you know, if it's possible to use those. Of course, people in the 1880s probably didn't have email, but maybe their descendants, if we were able to find them. It also provides a remedy in case, in the unexpected case, where this process will have been used, a grave will have been sold to a new purchaser, and potentially a burial will have occurred in it, and then a person who has an interest in that space appears later. The existing process requires that person to actually buy back the burial space. The process that we're proposing here provides for the provision of a comparable burial space at no cost, no additional cost, because it's already been purchased, obviously. The summary, I'm just trying to be brief here, and I've talked to all of you about this bill. In summary, the existing process involves costs to the cemetery owner and also to the public. The existing process requires the use of court resources and summons and foreclosures and all kinds of conflict-laden procedures. And it's only available to a limited subset of cemeteries. The process we're proposing provides greater notice to the existing owner, but also a realistic and implementable process for actually reclaiming some of these graves and making them available to the community once more. Happy to answer any questions about the bill or the rationale. And I haven't walked through the exact process in the bill, but I'd be happy to do that if you need that.
Oh, sure it is. You ask him.
I'm going to avoid any puns. I'm going to avoid any reference to the person who seems to be most interested in this topic, Senator Monroe. Senator George, do you have a question?
Nice avoidance there.
Randy, I think there's underlying issues here that we're not really getting to.
Randy, is there no property taxes paid on unused graves? Like, you can buy a grave site and there's no property tax on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, my understanding is that an unused grave is not real estate. Actually, Tim Farrell might be able to better answer that question.
That's a good question, because every state is different. And in the state of Oregon, a grave site, actually, when you purchase that, is a right of interment. So it's not really a real property thing that anybody can get onto to tax. Now, before that right of interment is transferred to an owner, it's just simply a part of the cemetery's real estate. In our case, we're a nonprofit, so correct. We would not pay any taxes on anything like that, nor would we pay after it's transferred. A cemetery of another, a for-profit, though, I would imagine, would have to pay real estate tax on that.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Any more questions? All right. We are in a public hearing, if I recall.
Senator Shields?
Yes.
I actually do have some insight from the small cemetery's perspective, if
yes,
you would like
please.
Me to give it to you. First of all, Tim Farrell of Hood River. Good to see you all again. I'm the secretary of the Cemetery Association of Oregon, and I'm here to report that we have distributed to our membership the fact that this legislation was coming down the pipe, and we did not receive any objections, and after consultation with the board, we do support this legislation. If enacted, this committee should know, it's not mandatory. It's not something that all cemeteries are going to go out and do. In fact, with the state of the cemetery business today, with the high rate of cremation, most going concerns have a vast surplus of plots available for sale. So it's not likely that this is going to be used much. And in fact, I don't think that I know of one or maybe two instances where the old law was ever used. But it's a good thing to have a reasonable way to do this. And I think I've got an example here which will kind of tell you, explain to you kind of the business that we're in. So we've got thousands of these small cemeteries
just
around the state. There's maybe 400 or 500 that are active. Myself, I just got my accounting stuff back. We did about $3,000 last year in revenue, and we spent like $3,100. So we lost money. A lot of time is donated by the community to make our cemetery go, and I've had people out there picking up sticks after the big storm. We are just that close to the edge of operating. We don't have any money to be able to do something like the present legislation would call for. As a perpetual care cemetery, in fact, there would never be a nuisance in the first place because we mow the whole cemetery, we keep the whole cemetery looking good. Now, I have here a deed from the Knights of Pythias dated March 1908. $5 was paid by Mr. D. Dodge for lot number 20, block H. That's 10 graves for $5. Currently, we sell those for $700-$800 a piece. This is quite a deal that this family got. Now, it just so happens, I've got a notation on the bottom of this that's a few years old that says, this plot is donated for future use by the cemetery by Wesley C. Dodge. Okay, he's an heir that's now lives in Eugene. Well, that's fine, but I don't really know that. I don't know. I haven't looked at the will. I haven't looked at the probate. I mean, I would really have to go back and see if this is really valid or not. Now, here's the thing that comes up. This family, they've moved to Eugene. They're obviously not going to use the space. There's a family member that's indicated that he would like to give it back. I may have a local family that will want to buy these 10 graves. At this time, I really have no realistic way that I could do that. But under the new legislation, I could say to this family, great, we've got this system. There's a process that you go through, and once we go through that process, I'll be happy to sell that to you and your family. It becomes a realistic method of using these abandoned graves. So for this legislation...
For $5?
This legislation really benefits the... Of course, it benefits us in that someday we may be able to sell these graves. But more importantly, if a family wants to buy these graves, in which clearly have been abandoned, then this new legislation will allow ordinary Oregon citizens a realistic method of doing that. Thank you.
Okay. Good. That was helpful. I was wondering the impact, particularly on small funeral home operators and cemetery.
Further questions?
You can propose the amendment.
All right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1537, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1537. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 1537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Would the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Boquist?
Yep.
Senator Dean Felder?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. The motion to pass Senate Bill 1537 to the floor is carried, and the carrier will be Senator Monroe.
This committee is probably
going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1537, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1548. Jan, would you please tee it up for us?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 1548 prohibits the publication in print or on the internet any advertisement for a job vacancy that limits the applicants to those who are not currently unemployed, imposes a civil penalty not to exceed $1,000 for a violation. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact, and this statement has been issued.
Senator Rosenbaum, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. You didn't recognize me, I'm sure, from this angle. So, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. You're all looking great up there. And for the record, my name is Senator Diane Rosenbaum, representing District 21, which is in southeast and northeast Portland and Milwaukee and Clackamas County. Thank you very much for scheduling Senate Bill 1548. I know that you have a lot of people signed up to testify on this bill, and I will just make some very brief comments to introduce the bill. I'm sure, as the committee members are all well aware, we have had a very, very devastating economy and a situation that has faced
hardworking Oregonians who are struggling to keep jobs or get back to work and find jobs, and that's been going on for a very long time. Senate Bill 1548, which we call the Fair Employment Opportunity Act, is not a panacea, but it will address one aspect of the obstacles that are facing people that have been out of work and are trying to compete for the jobs that are there that they can qualify for. Just for a little background, and I know that they are in the room, but the Employment Department tells us that over 175,000 Oregonians were unemployed in December of last year. That's still an 8.9% employment rate. We are grateful we've dropped finally below the 9% level, but some of the underlying statistics are that 4 in 10 of those Oregonians were unemployed and have been without a job for 6 months or more, in some cases for significantly longer time than that. The average unemployed worker spends 9 months out there trying to find a job before getting back to work. And so the bill before you addresses one aspect of that problem. Senate Bill 1548 simply prohibits the listing of advertisements for jobs which state in some form that the only people that can apply for these jobs are people who are currently employed. It stands to reason that if you're out of work and you need a job, it should not be and not isn't very fair to say that the only people that can actually apply are the very people who don't necessarily need the job because they've already got one, and that's simply what the bill does. You'll hear from many other people about the situation that's faced by people that are struggling in this situation and why it's important to various groups of Oregonians. But I want to just point out one thing in the bill because this question has been asked of me. I've been asked, does anything in this bill prohibit employers from considering people's employment history or work experience? And it's very clear, and I would point you to Section 2, Sub 3 of the bill, that it states that nothing in the bill is meant to or does prevent an employer or a hiring agency from considering training, experience, certifications, or any of the other qualifications, which are obviously a very legitimate part of an application process. So clearly the bill does not have any unintended consequences that would make it more difficult for employers who are trying to weed through a lot of applicants to be able to consider the very things that they should legitimately be able to consider. It's a very simple bill. Legislation like this passed last year in the state of New Jersey. Numerous other states, as well as the federal government, are considering similar legislation, and I would commend the bill to you. Thank you very much for allowing me to kick it off, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum. We appreciate you coming all this way for this, this hearing. Representative Smith, would you like to testify on this bill?
Agreed, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name for the record is Jefferson Smith. I represent District 47 in the State House. I want to commend Senator Rosenbaum for her leadership on this. I'll repeat a few things just, you know, for fun, and then add just a couple of thoughts, but be brief. We face a significant unemployment problem across the country. I hear it in my district. I know that I'm not alone. I don't agree with the Oregonian about everything, but I do agree that the real unemployment rate is almost certainly significantly higher than the reported unemployment rate. And nationally, the average duration of unemployment has climbed to 40 weeks, which is the longest, I think, since the Great Depression. Limiting openings to workers with current employment can further a cycle of unemployment, and advertising it can send messages that discourage job seekers. And while polls, one fact I want to offer, while polls should not guide our best judgment, it's instructive that people support the concept. The recent poll we got, we did not conduct it, but that we were shared with on, show that 80% of respondents consider the practice not only unfair, but very unfair. And we're borrowing the concept from a similar bill signed by Governor Christie in New Jersey. Again, to reiterate a couple of the Senator's points, the bill will not solve our state's significant unemployment challenge, nor, to be very clear, will it prohibit employers from taking relevant experience into account and choosing the best candidate. That is absolutely expected. It'll be a humble step, but it'll send a message to employers that this sort of unemployment discrimination is unfair, and a message to the unemployed that we are thinking about them and they are not forgotten.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Smith, anyone else? Questions for Representative Smith? All right. Thank you very much for testifying. Could we please bring up Midge Purcell and Jeanette, that's right, and Marcia Warren.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee.
Senator Shields, Vice Chair George, and members of the committee. My name is Mitch Purcell, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the Urban League of Portland. And I'm here to speak in support of the Fair Employment Opportunity Act, SB 1548. Senator Rosenbaum and Representative Smith said, is a bill that would prohibit employers from explicitly stating in job ads that the unemployed need not apply. They also eloquently reminded us of the unemployment rate in Oregon, in that more and more Oregonians are facing longer and longer periods of unemployment. And we believe that this is yet another barrier to unemployed Oregonians who are desperate to get back to work, and that this barrier should be removed. We've been asked when we've been speaking to legislators about this bill whether this practice actually exists, and unfortunately it does. Recent sampling from the National Employment Law Project shows that the practice of excluding unemployed job seekers persists, and these ads were found on CareerBuilders.com, Indeed.com, Monster.com, and Craigslist. And staffing firms were responsible for about half of the discriminatory postings in their survey. And my own perusal of job listings this weekend found similar must be currently employed language in our very own WorkSource Oregon job listing site just this very weekend. So we believe that all Oregonians who are currently unemployed will benefit from SB 1548, and particularly women who have trying to enter the workforce and after raising children or caring for family members, and also workers from communities of color and rural areas who tend to face higher levels of employment and longer periods of unemployment. The Urban League supports this bill because we want to see all Oregonians with a fair chance to get back to work. Our constituents, the African American community, tend to experience higher unemployment rates. It's hovering about 18%, and more likely to experience multiple spells of unemployment regardless of their education levels. So this is a small step. It's a very small step, but I think it's an important step. We would like to see unemployment addressed on multiple levels, not only removing barriers, but also the creation of job training opportunities, access to living wage jobs, and a commitment to creating a sustainable, healthy, diverse workforce. This bill is modest, and I also would like to say that there is no opposition to this bill, so we respectfully urge you to support. Thank you.
The day is young.
Oh. Good morning. My name is Jeanette Lompian. Thanks for the opportunity to testify and your time and attention. I'm here as a member of the Urban League in support of Bill SB 1548, the Fair Opportunity Employment Act. I'm a recent transplant to Portland from Montpellier, France. I've been searching for employment for the past 8 months. Two of those months I was in France. Six of those months I've been in Portland. That's not been a happy process. I only seek an opportunity to contribute to my new home by finding a job and making a living wage, but it's been frustrating. I'm highly educated with a solid background and a variety of skills and experience, but I'm unemployed. I've redone my resume, you know, contacted people who redo your resume for you for money. I've worked with temp agencies, recruiters. I've networked. I've talked to anybody who seemed like they could hire me to do something, but I'm here. I'm unemployed. I've applied to many, many jobs. Unemployed. There's so many barriers to finding employment already. Not allowing the unemployed to apply for a job because they're unemployed is just, it's too much. It's unfair. Being unemployed when all you really want to do is work, it's very painful. It's painful not to have the opportunity to use your skills and experience to benefit the employer and the larger community you live in. It's painful to send resumes and have all these wonderful interviews, but at the end of the day, there's still a no. It's painful not to have business or responsibility or community or anything outside of just getting up in the morning and trying to pull yourself together to send more resumes that you'll still maybe hear no. So it's painful and embarrassing also not to earn your own money and be able to participate fully in society because you don't earn your own money. So unemployment is painful. There are enough barriers to accessing work. I ask that you please support SB 1548 because no matter the reasons people are unemployed, they still deserve an opportunity to at least apply.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, please?
Good morning. Thank you for letting me come and speak on behalf of SB 1548 this morning. Chairman Shields and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Warner, and I'm a senior SPHR, that's a senior professional in human resources, with over 15 years of experience in my field, and my particular specialty is talent acquisition. I'm also a member of the Society for HR Management, SHRM, as well as the local chapter, PHRMA, P-H-R-M-A, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 1548, the Fair Employment Opportunity Act. Many people are beginning to question, is being unemployed the new discrimination? I know a fellow who recently interviewed for a promising position, and this fellow is a very senior level contributor. And the first words out of the interviewer's mouth were, why am I talking to someone who's unemployed? It was very distressing to my friend. His unemployment status should not be a factor in determining his qualifications to do the job. But while the comment was rude and inconsiderate and insensitive, it's not illegal. We see this attitude not only in interviews, but they're starting to pervade job postings and starting to erode confidence and ability to move forward in for the unemployed. And that's why I ask you to support this bill. This recession has hit our most experienced workers. Our workforce is aging. According to the State of Oregon unemployment statistics, in 1995, only 10% of the regional workforce in Oregon was 55 years or over. Today, it's about twice that, meaning about 20% of our workforce are over the age of 55. Not hiring someone because they are unemployed could affect a greater percentage of the population who are over the age of 55, and we know that the age of 40 and over is considered a protected class. Mitchell Hirsch of the National Employment Law Project notes that people who have been out of work for 3 or 6 months or a year or more tend to be somewhat older workers, more mature workers, people with 2 to 3 decades of work experience. Hirsch says that their skills are not eroding. They're able and willing and ready to get back to work. It was the economy that threw them overboard. Given that the average duration of unemployment today is 9 months, a record high, limiting a search to the recently employed, much less the currently employed, disqualifies millions of qualified, hardworking Oregonians, many of whom are over the age of 40, who, through no fault of their own, have lost their jobs during the most difficult job market since the Depression. Such practices can have other unintended consequences. William Spriggs, Assistant Secretary for Policy of the U.S. Department of Labor, pointed out that because blacks and Latinos have a higher unemployment rate, discrimination against the unemployed could disproportionately affect those minority groups. When employers exclude the unemployed from the applicant pool, they are likely to be excluding Latinos and African Americans, says Briggs. And what about our returning veterans? They are also subject to being unfairly impacted by such discriminatory job posting processes. People become unemployed for various reasons, not just the economic downturn. They might take a sabbatical for travel, for family needs, education, or other personal reasons, as well as an economic downturn. On one side, we encourage work-life balance and encourage workers to find a way to have a personal and professional life balance. On the other side, we may be discriminating against highly qualified individuals who, for personal reasons, have decided to take time to attend to an ill parent's final months, raise children. I know I personally took 5 years away from the treadmill to raise my 3 daughters, travel, increase their education, or otherwise seek personal fulfillment. We may doom these people to chronic unemployment. It just doesn't make sense if you can't get a job. If you're unemployed and you're unemployed, you can't get a job. We must continue to screen and select candidates on their ability to bring knowledge, skills, and abilities to perform the job. In the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VII, and the Age Discrimination Employment Act, the ADEA of 1967, laid the groundwork that Americans shall not be discriminated against during the hiring practice. Let's not make being unemployed the next discriminated class. Everyone I know who's received unemployment benefits would much rather be receiving a paycheck. Discriminating against people who are qualified yet unemployed is an added indignity that our economy cannot afford. Intolerance has many faces. Let's not make being unemployed the next face. I urge you to support Senate Bill 1548. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Warner. Could you remind us again what you do for a profession?
I'm a human resources professional.
Thank you. Could we please bring up Jan Meekums, J.L. Wilson, and Beth Cook.
Can I ask Senator Rosenbaum a question?
Yes, Senator George to Senator Rosenbaum.
Senator Rosenbaum, my concern about the bill is the private right of action.
Senator George, the bill does not have a private right of action. I can...
It's in the not category.
Yeah.
Okay.
It definitely says that it does not have a private right of action.
Okay. Senator George, I just want you to know that I saw that in the bill, too, after I already signed on and almost passed out.
Okay.
And so then I had to go back and reread the bill, and it's a double negative if you look down there that LC did. So.
Okay.
But we are open to amendments if you'd like. welcome to the committee, JL.
Thank you. Chair Shields and members, for the record, J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. Our position is one of, we took no position on this bill. We talked about it at length and studied it within the context of our Employment Practices Committee, so we are neutral. But I do feel like I need to draw the conversation back to what the bill actually does, because previous testimony seems to indicate that this bill has far broader implication and reach than it actually does. This bill simply limits the way an employer advertises an available position. That's it. Nothing more. It does not confer rights of action, private rights of action, which is something obviously that we're grateful for. It does not also, although it kind of tiptoes around this, but it does not get up to the point of creating a new protected class, which is something we're very sensitive to, but we are persuaded that this bill does not do that. There's nothing in the bill that precludes an employer who does not want to consider someone who's unemployed for a position. There's nothing in this bill that says that they have to do that as part of their interview process. This bill is simply about how an employer advertises for an available position. It is our understanding that the advertisements for these positions that limit to just people who are currently employed, it's in poor taste. Our members do not do this. I understand that, which is why we do not oppose the bill, because I think most employers, probably 99% plus, because I think we're talking about a fraction of 1% here, the vast majority of employers do not do this. It's in bad taste, and it also probably unnecessarily limits your pool of applicants, so that is why most people don't do it. But I want to be very clear, this bill just deals expressly with how employers advertise their positions, and because the bill is limited in such a fashion, we're neutral on that.
Thank you for clarifying the record. Appreciate that. Jan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Shields and co-chair and committee members. My name for the record is Jan Meekums, State Director for National Federation of Independent Business. Representing small business, our typical business has less than 10 employees. In fact, the average is 3.5 employees, and we have about 7,000 members in the state of Oregon. And we've gone back and forth between neutral and opposition to this bill because we are so sensitive to the unemployment situation in Oregon and the huge numbers that have been unemployed for too long. So we don't want to do anything to discourage active employment for those individuals that desperately need a job. On the same token, as was previously mentioned by Senator George, regulation is such a huge issue for our small business owners. And as he has two full-time employees that deal with that, most of our members do not have the resources to employ anyone to deal with regulation. They have to do it themselves and wear all of the hats in the small business. So we are just concerned about a protected class. That has been set aside to some extent by JL, and that if that in fact is the case, that it does not create a protected class because our business members, one of their key issues is how do I keep from being sued? How do I keep from my employees making reports? Sometimes they're valid and that absolutely does need to be done, but we don't want to open up this broad horizon for another situation of liability for our small business owners. So I would retract our opposition and say at this point we're just concerned and we just want to make sure that it doesn't overstep the boundaries and create broad issues for our members.
Thank you for wrestling with this.
Yes.
Beth, welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Beth Cook, and I am here today on behalf of Family Forward Oregon in support of Senate Bill 1548, the Fair Employment Opportunity Act. Family Forward is a nonprofit organization working to create family-friendly workplace and public policies that work for today's families. We appreciate the Urban League in particular for championing this bill. I am a former manager of continuing education programs and have coached and advised thousands of working adults through the years on how to build their skills and develop the career of their dreams. I was a member of the Society for Human Resource Management for over 10 years and at one point even maintained a job board for HR professionals. I am also here today as someone who has been unemployed during this recession. I was laid off from my job in 2009 after 10 years of service to my former employer due to statewide budget cuts during the middle of the fiscal cycle. I believe people would tell you I was very good at my job and provided a strong value for my organization, but my role at the time was in marketing and public relations, a field that has been hit particularly hard by this recession. I was told very early on by my contacts to take steps to protect my resume. The current job market was incredibly difficult, and as someone who was unemployed, I would face additional challenges finding a new position, particularly as I had been working part-time for a number of years while raising my young children. I've done everything I can to heed this advice and have continued while looking for a new job to develop my skills through volunteer opportunities and project work where it is available. I was lucky that my spouse has kept his job and we've been able to trim our expenses. Not all families have been so fortunate. I have spoken to many fellow moms who have spent years at home serving as caregivers but are now looking for work due to the recession. The search is not an easy one. I do not know if any of my applications have been bypassed due to my work history. I can tell you I have found a number of postings over the last 2 years, particularly in marketing and sales, which indicate applicants must be currently employed in order to apply. I have to say your stomach drops a little bit when you see these things, when you're actively looking for a job. The postings I have found are normally through placement agencies or online sites such as Monster.com, Careers.com, or on Craigslist. I maintain my belief that none of the true HR professionals I know would ever utilize this practice, and I know many HR professionals. There are other better means for screening applicants based on their merit and abilities. Senate Bill 1548 is a modest proposal. It would not require an employer to hire someone who has been out of work due to unemployment or motherhood, but it would ban the discriminatory language in job postings. Their exemptions of current employer is necessary for their job requirements. Other states are moving forward with similar legislation, and Oregon must take steps to end this practice as well. This is a common sense bill, and the members of Family Forward Oregon urge you to support Senate Bill 1548. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Senator Boquist.
Actually, I just have a couple of comments upon the record, and now's a pretty good time. I said earlier I'll try just about anything to get people back to work, and 3 years ago, if I thought Senator Rosenbaum and I would be co-sponsoring this bill, I would have told NFIB and AOI that it never happened. We're in a different environment right now than we've ever been in before. We're kind of in true virgin territory. Earlier, Senator George expressed his emotional concerns about one of the other bills, and our company has been raided before. You know, they come in, they raid your employees, and, you know, under the federal contract laws, you know, we could sue the 1% bad people. But I think everybody in here knows that when you start hiring lawyers, money starts going up, and if you're a small business, you don't have. You know, there's all kinds of people make broad, sweeping statements about rich people and the top 1%, so on and so forth. But most small business people have to work day to day in their own companies to keep them afloat, and I'm no different. So I've been raided. I've got people waiting to raid us again because of the defense industry is downsizing and they want to get employees. And more importantly, with 51 employees, I know what unemployment insurance is. I mean, the unemployment folks are back there. We have to pay these bills. We have to pay the quarterlies. Larry and Senator Shields, Senator Dingfelter, and I'm not sure about Senator Rosenbaum, you know, they're involved as employers too, and we get it. We're in this top bracket right now. We're in virgin territory. I don't think that the three Democrats up here would be voting for Governor Christie, but, you know, this is a new type of environment we're in which we're trying to come up with any way we can to get the long-term unemployed back to work. Because when they go back to work, my UI insurance rate in my company goes down. So, again, this is kind of one of those out there reaching to say, we don't know if this is going to work, but it's, you know, again, virgin territory. Let's do whatever we can to try and get people back to work. And I hope we're not setting up more regulations. And as I want to just reiterate, this is about advertising, getting the most qualified people in there. So I just wanted to put it on the record because I know some of the people in the business industry think that I've gone rogue out there. But I get that quarterly. It's not the UI, but I get the quarterly assessment that comes with the UI, and it's like, now where are we going to come up with this money on a day-to-day basis? Thank you, Senator Shields.
Thank you for those points, Senator Boquist. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum. Just briefly, I wanted to especially thank JL and Jan for testifying, as well as everybody else, because I think there are bills that have been introduced or model bills in other states that are much more far-reaching and probably would be seen as burdensome. This bill was deliberately crafted to not put an undue hardship on our small businesses in particular that are having their own set of challenges. And I think it's in everybody's best interest to make sure that we don't make it harder, that we find ways for business to be able to survive and grow and be able to put people back to work. And that's what we all want to do. So I want to thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Could we bring up next, please, Sybil Hebb, Bob Tackett, and Alana Guinea.
The department on your list? Or are they going to bow out?
They have not signed up to testify, but if you have questions for them.
No. Shoot, move, communicate, move faster. You know me. I'm in the papers.
You and me both, buddy. Welcome to the committee, Sybil.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here in support of Senate Bill 1548. Just want to express my great appreciation to the co-sponsors of this bill and to the advocates and the work that's gone into bringing this concept forward. At the Oregon Law Center, as you know, our goal is to achieve justice for low-income communities. We have unfortunately seen an incredible rise in the number of people, formerly middle-class often, who now qualify for our services because of having been laid off or lost their jobs through no fault of their own, just as a result of the economic crisis. And it's this population of folks we feel will be really helped and assisted by the bill. Without this protection, we worry that many people are suffering from kind of a double whammy. They've lost their income, they're struggling to go out and get new work, and yet they're precluded as a result of the fact that they are unemployed from even having a review, the chance to submit an application for new work. So we very much appreciate the policy behind the bill. We agree agree that it's simple, that it does not impose a burden that would prevent employers from assessing and analyzing whether an applicant is qualified because of job skills, job experience, references, and the like. It simply allows people to have a shot at applying and being considered. So we appreciate the help. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. You know, I think we all agree that we shouldn't be discriminating against the unemployed. Unfortunately, there are some businesses out there that have. We have an affiliate, Working America, who works with many unemployed Oregonians, and I won't go into all of the stories they've heard from their members about the job postings they've seen. Most of them are not in the negative. They are not, if you are unemployed, do not apply. They're worded in the positive. Please have full employment history. Please don't have breaks in your employment. Things that sound great and positive, and then you read it again and realize that it's saying you can't apply because your company went bankrupt or went through a layoffs and you're out of work. You know, our unemployment rate has been getting a little bit better. We have created jobs in Oregon, and that's great, but the long-term unemployed are the group who are still hurting the most. They are the group who are still having the most trouble finding employment and getting back to work, and that is the group that this bill will help the most. When you are out of work for up to a year, over a year sometimes, you know, when you're out of work for 6 months and you are devastated that you can't find a job, it's easy to get discouraged. We've heard many people up here talking about the discouragement that you feel at that point. But when those workers get discouraged, what happens is they stop looking for employment. They stop applying for unemployment insurance. They fall off our radar. We don't know then what our unemployment rate is. We don't know if we're creating the jobs we need, and we have people who aren't getting any of the assistance they need. They're not able to get help for their family. They're not able to get training they need through our workforce system because they're no longer on our books. And this will help those people from becoming discouraged, falling off our books, and falling out of a place where they can get the services they need. We hope you support this bill. Thank you very much.
Mr. Tackett.
Thank you, Chair Seals. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Tackett. I'm the Executive Secretary-Treasurer of the Northwest Oregon Labor Council. I provided a letter that was given to me by Vicki Burns from Labor Community Services, and if I may, I'd like to summarize some of that letter. I encourage you guys to read the letter. It's very well written, but I'm going to be brief and summarize it. Labor Community Service Agency is a nonprofit United Way organization. They provide a temporary hardship program helping people survive the impact of joblessness. And when they're working with these folks and they ask, what can we do for you, the main thing that they hear back is, we need a job. We want to go back to work. We need to get back to work. Vicki says, in a rocky economic climate, it is challenging enough for workers who have lost jobs to bounce back and find another. This legislation would discourage employers from using discriminatory hiring practices and restore a measure of fairness in filling job openings. And again, I encourage you to read the rest of the letter. From my point of view, experts say that of the life-altering events in a person's life, such as death in a family, divorce, serious illness, losing your job ranks among the highest stress-causing situations. And I can attest to that personally. I worked for 26 years in an aluminum plant. They shut the plant down. I became a dislocated worker. I became unemployed. It was very stressful. To then take that whole class of people and say you can't even apply for a job because you're unemployed seems to me to be cruel, unfair, and it's just wrong. So I'm asking that you guys pass the Fair Employment Opportunity Act to prevent the discriminatory actions that some employers are currently practicing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tackett. Any questions? Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? All right. Okay, we're not ready to move this one yet today, so I will...
Mr. Chair, I just want to put a plug in for the unemployment department. For unemployment, yeah. That's what it is, frankly. Employment department, if you indulge me for just 20 seconds here. I want to kind of publicly thank Graham Slater in the employment department, all of the members up here. Graham has been working with our office and several other offices to establish the U6 rate and what is the true unemployment rate. That's, you know, the underemployed, those that are employed, unemployed, looking for a job that are no longer eligible for benefits, so on and so forth, and all of the members up here receive a copy of that monthly report. So the members up here at the diocese are aware of the true nature of the problem, which, again, the business community says I've gone rogue on them, but that's the issue right there. That long-term U6 unemployment rate around 18% in the state of Oregon, you know, we've got to get it down to a real, you know, 9% U6, 5%, ideally a job for everybody. But until we get that rate down, we're not going to see an economic recovery, and then we're not going to see additional funds for government programs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for that comment.
And Mr. Chair, just I do see Legislative Council in the room. I think if there still is any confusion about whether the bill creates a private right of action, I'm sure they would be happy to clear that up. But I would just point out on line 17, the language is nothing in this section shall be construed to, and that applies to lines 28 through 30, create or authorize a private right of action. So I think it may be a little bit not one line right after the other, but it's very clear that the bill does not create a private right of action. Also, while we've been sitting here, the revenue forecast apparently has been delivered in another room, and I don't have any late-breaking news about that. I'm sure you'll be hearing about it, but I know that part of what was talked about is that long-term unemployment continues to be a problem, and the numbers that we're seeing, and I'm sure those can be verified by people like Graham Slater, who does such good work, are numbers we have not seen even during the Great Depression. So this is a staggering problem here in Oregon and across the country.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. All right. I will close the... Do you want Legislative Council to come up, or are we feeling comfortable?
I think that once I looked up a little higher, I saw
the double
negative.
All right. We will roll... Well, no, we won't roll this over. We'll schedule it for a work session. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1548, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1518. Jan, could you tee it up?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 1518 has three major provisions. The first provision prevents a state contracting agency from accepting a bid from a contractor if that contractor actually assisted the agency in developing the solicitation materials. The second major provision is a reporting from DAS to the Legislative Assembly information about contracting activities on businesses that are headquartered in Oregon and information on special procurements. And the third major provision is to allow a bidder or proposer to submit a personnel deployment disclosure with their bid or their proposal, and it allows the agency to give a preference to the bidder or proposer based on that personnel deployment disclosure. The provisions become operative January 1st, 2013, declares an emergency, which is effective on passage. You have before you a -1 amendment. It exempts the Secretary of State and the State Treasurer from the bill. Deletes proposed requirements the department report the information to the Legislative Assembly on those businesses headquartered in Oregon, and specifies that records maintained for the new reporting provisions are not to be used to evaluate proposals or invitations to bid, and it removes any provisions in the bill that were related to the code on construction contracting. That would be Chapter 279C. There is no revenue impact, and we are waiting to hear from fiscal office on the impact.
Senator Rosenbaum, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to be my day in the hopper here. So for the record, my name is Senator Diane Rosenbaum from District 21. I did want to offer just a few brief comments on this bill and the -1 amendment. This bill came and was introduced through the Senate Committee on Rules, and so... thought it would be appropriate to just kick it off here. So Senate Bill 1518 is meant to address some concerns about a lack of transparency and some appearance that perhaps our public contracting could be done in a more transparent and fairer way. And I think that the bill is, as the committee administrator ably described it, has some pretty modest provisions in it. But passage of this bill, I think, with the -1 amendment would be a significant step to provide some much needed transparency and accountability and a more level playing field in the way the state
administers contracts, which are a crucial part, obviously, of faith of the public in our being good stewards of the dollars that we have. Just the three simple recommendations, the committee administrator described them, but currently there is nothing in Oregon state law that prevents a vendor from writing the specifications of a contract and then turning around and bidding on that very same contract that they helped develop. And the bill before you with the Dash 1 amendments applies a limitation on doing that only to professional service contracts, not to construction contracts. The bill as drafted would have applied more broadly. The Dash 1s narrow it to professional service contracts. And there are exceptions, obviously, if a case can be made that for some reason there is limited expertise and there needs to be that expertise brought into development of a contract. The bill requires some reporting by the Department of Administrative Services about special procurements. This provision is there because of some high-profile examples that have been in the newspapers of late of large contracts that have been awarded on a no-bid basis, and special procurement is one of the types of contracting that creates a path to avoid competitive bidding. So the bill would require a report every other year about the special use of special procurements and which contracts were awarded under those provisions. It only applies to special procurements that are under the authority of the Department of Administrative Services, and that would give us a better sense of how our valuable resources are being allocated. I think this provision will help. In closing, I just want to note that we have been working very, very hard, staff Katie Shriver from my office and others, with the stakeholders who are concerned, because obviously state contracting laws are an extremely complicated area of the law, and we certainly have been very careful not to do anything to negatively impact them. But I think this bill is a compromise that will make some very solid and valuable improvements in how Oregon does business, and I would urge your support of Senate Bill 1518.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum. Any questions for Senator Dinkelbaum?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Question, because this is, as somebody used to work for a large consulting firm, unfortunately, this is fairly common practice. Would this have, the way I'm reading this is just solely limited to state agencies. So this practice also occurs pretty widespread at the state, at the local level. And so I don't know if there's been any discussions or even if we would have jurisdiction over that for local contracting. I'm not sure if you know the answer, if we can bring somebody out that can
answer
that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder. And you're right, the bill does not have any application for local governments. Obviously, a lot of contracting is done by other entities. But I think given what I had said earlier about the complexity of these laws, we didn't choose to look at broader application. And I think, you know, if we are able to gather information and set up some model procedures, certainly those could become a model for local governments too. I failed to mention just one provision of the bill, which is the second reporting requirement, and that is the provision that calls for there to be permissive language in the bill to allow bidders to include in their bid information about how many jobs would be created and where these jobs would be located. And collecting that data, obviously, would be extremely important and useful. We spend a lot of time in this building talking about job creation and sometimes are just sort of speculating about the effects of some of the scarce resources that we're spending. So I think by including that, it would be helpful at knowing and being able to actually quantify how many jobs could result from various contracts. So all right, thank you again.
Thank you. Could we please bring up Diane Lancaster, John Rakowitz, and Greg Miller?
Good morning, Chair Shields and members of the committee.
For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm here to provide some information and feedback about Senate Bill 1518, the Dash 1 draft, as it stands before us. I would first like to also thank Senator Rosenbaum and her staff, particularly Ms. Shriver, for working with us, working through our legislative coordinating about how this bill can be framed to achieve the goals she has in mind, and I appreciated hearing her comments. It's always helpful for those of us who implement these bills to know the reasons behind the bill and the need for it. As has been laid out, there are three major sections of the bill. The draft one amendment, or the Dash 1 amendments, do narrow the sections 1 and 2, which really get to an issue around personal service contracts for those kinds of firms or entities who provide advice and assistance to state agencies in preparing solicitation documents. This particular model would have those agencies, if they wish to contract for those services, and then also wish to have to be able to take a bid from those companies on the services, to come to DAS and to have an exception process and to explain what they're doing and why they are doing it. The current process for special procurements is very similar, and we feel that the process laid out in Sections 1 and 2 will probably fit fairly neatly into that current process. What we don't know, of course, is the additional volume that could be created. We process between 50 and 80 special procurements in the arena of Section B, which is trade services and goods, per year. So 50 to 80 items now, and we think there may be, you know, this is one of those, if you want to do it, you must come and get an exception. So we just don't know what that might mean. Sections 3 and 4 do commit DAS to some new reports, and the reporting on special procurements, again, we collect a fair amount of information around special procurements anyway, so that's not terribly burdensome. The bill does add a couple of new elements about what was the rest of the story, how many contracts actually were let, and what was the dollar value of those contracts as a result of that special procurement method. So it's kind of getting that after the fact, or after the method is approved, what happened. We don't currently collect this, and so that would require us to do so. I did have a telephone meeting yesterday with representatives of 9 different state agencies because I wanted to get their perspective on these were procurement officers about, okay, you know, how burdensome is that going to be. We did read this section to still include 279C construction exemptions. So we did want to ask for maybe a closer review of that and to make a determination, was that still the intent of the drafters? So there was that one question of clarification around sections 3 and 4. If it is reporting in any event, we will proceed accordingly. So again, a couple of new elements of reporting on that, but some of it already being captured. Finally, the preference on personnel deployment disclosure, it's a discretionary preference. It's at the choice of the agency. If they wish to call it out and to encourage this type of disclosure in their solicitations and then be in a position to apply a preference, it is at their discretion. One question that did come up from my talking group was if there could be an inadvertent impact on small businesses who might be disadvantaged because larger businesses could claim that they are going to employ more workers or they're going to put more workers on the ground for a particular project. So we raised that question. Again, we didn't have a solution to that issue, but it was, you know, we all noted that this was at the choice of the agency. I just wanted to comment, I did check in with the DAS Chief Information Officer, his office, and they noted that they believe there have been increased needs for outside assistance in many of the state agencies' information technology projects. And so the impact of Sections 1 and 2, you might see some uptick in that because of
what they said there has been increased need for some of that outside contracting help in developing solicitations for IT projects. So with that, I'm available for any questions that you have. And again, I want to thank the Senator's office for working with us so closely.
Good morning, Chair Shields, members of the committee. John Rakowitz with AGC, Associated General Contractors. When the bill first came out, we had some significant red flags go off. I am here today to support Dash 1 amendments. We think there were unintended consequences in the original drafting of the bill around the public improvement construction contracting 279C, which is no longer involved in this bill with the Dash 1s. I will be submitting on the letterhead of Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt a couple of tweaks on the language, just clarification tweaks that I'd urge the committee to look at. This information has been provided to Katie in Senator Rosenbaum's office. I just wanted to make sure it's a memo to me from our board counsel, a couple of tweaks in the language. I'll submit that here in a minute. I don't think it requires any discussion. And along with everybody else, I'm just very pleased with the discussions we've had with Senator Rosenbaum's office and here to support the Dash 1 amendments and answer any questions if anybody has any. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Greg Miller, here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Associated Wall and Ceiling Contractors. Similar to my colleague from Associated General Contractors, we did have some concerns with the bill at first as it related to ORS 279C, but with the Dash 1 amendments, we do find ourselves neutral on the bill. I will say with some of the complexity and technical issues of some of the projects that the state takes on, it's necessary for the state to get feedback from contractors that have that expertise, so it's important for those folks to be able to communicate about the details and technical components of a project before issuing bid documents. So again, with the Dash 1s, thank you for those, and we are neutral on the bill.
All right. Senator George.
I kind of want to get at this issue. I think what the Senator is trying to get at, if I understand this correctly, is that it creates an inherent conflict of interest that maybe somebody has an inside line. And so, obviously, we're trying to get at that. For the parts that are going to be dealt with, that are going to be excluded from the Dash 1s, ultimately, at the end of the day, the question still exists. And we're doing this heavier contracting, road building, that kind of stuff. How do we make sure that everybody has a fair shot at it and that if there's consulting going on, that some contractor doesn't get preferential treatment because of the fact that they're participating in this? Because I think the question still exists, even if we amend it out of this bill to move it forward. That issue still is there, and it actually, this is, I appreciate the Senator for bringing this forward, because interesting issue.
Chair Shields, Senator George, there's a variety of ways that this is done. The first thing I will point to is that this committee and others are quite aware of the contentious nature of issues associated with public construction contracting in the last session. As a result of that, there has been a 21-22 member work group put together that I think is exactly the kind of group that needs to look at that and other issues, and they're particularly going to look at construction and in particular the CMGC model, where it's an exemption, where it's not low bid. The basic principle in the state of Oregon, unless you apply for an exemption under the law, is least cost, responsible bid. So there's a hard bid sort of floor. The issues usually come up around when you're doing exemptions, and that's why the focus of that work group. That work group is co-chaired by a DOJ attorney who specializes and represents DAS and others, as well as a private sector attorney who spent their entire career in construction law. It has a wide range and mix of small, large, every type of specialty general contractor. It also has a wide range of public owner to look at those issues, because the public owners have an interest in using that type of delivery model, CMGC and others. So there is a group, and there are, by the way, no lobbyists on this. This is purely the people, the principals who conduct this business on both sides. So we look forward, and we are participating, we look forward to that group's efforts to look at that. I will say that there are a variety of means in the environment that the construction industry faces today. were one half of what we were as an industry. We were 5% of the economy when this downturn started. We're today 2.5%. So that's a collapse of an industry. A lot of issues like this have become that much more important, and this group is looking at them. I will say there are all kinds of means and mechanisms. There are bid protests. There are a lot more of those going on. If people see real egregious issues, I'll guarantee you people are not shy in today's environment of using bid protest and other methods to pursue that. So I think there are methods today, but there is a bigger policy discussion going on, and the anticipation is that they will be bringing forth, come this fall, recommendations for consideration in 2013. If that helps.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'm compelled to make a couple of comments here. 1518, which I really didn't read until this morning, it's kind of ironic, but it really brings us in line with federal acquisition regulations. About 25-30% of our existing budget, all funds budget, comes from the federal government. A lot of those big ODOT projects, I mean, the same people building roads are building stuff for the feds, and it kind of brings this line. Two things jump out at me that are good in this thing, ironically, that have come up in the last 24 hours, and I'm experienced personally with these. One is the exception that's in here about, you know, when do you accept, you know, complete open competitive bidding? And under the federal statutes, I mean, it's easy to say, well, they got a sole source contract or they got this, so on and so forth. But even under those statutes, it's very much similar to what's in this bill. It reasonably expected to result in substantial cost savings, otherwise substantially promotes public interest. You know, it saves money, saves lives. There's a disaster. We had a tsunami. We had a Cascadia fault. I'll say this one, you know, we went to war with Iran when we shouldn't have, something along that. Things come up, but those exception clauses already exist in there. The second thing that's under the federal acquisition regulation that people like to ignore is that's in this here, and it's what was brought up about the personnel deployment disclosure. Federal acquisition regulation for a large contract, and AGC's contractors are familiar with this, you have to have a defense contract auditing agency audit come to you, audit you. They identify all the personnel you have. Do you meet Davis-Bacon? Do you meet Service Contract Act? All of that's all put out in a matrix and is already identified under federal law. And in fact, you know, our compliance here and the fact that it's kind of voluntary here is nice to the state, but as the contracting officers know in our large agencies, these are things they already have to do in the federal contracts. I mean, people like to claim broad sweeping statements, but we're really simply aligning with the existing federal law, trying to do it in a manner in which it doesn't slow down the department, and once again, our harp of the day gets people to work quickly.
All right. Any other comments for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. We are not ready to move this either, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1518. And
Mr. Chair, question, point of order.
Oh, that's a good point.
Do you want to put the amendment in case the fiscal changes and fiscal comes back and jumps us next week and says we can't do it?
That makes sense to me. If you'd like to do that, Senator Rosenbaum.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
Well, then I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1518. Do you want to make the motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1518.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1518. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1518. Colleagues, let's stand at ease for just a moment while I figure out where we are on Senate Bills 1552 and 1564. Kelly, I will bring the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee back to order. Colleagues, what we've decided to do is, since we don't have all of the paperwork, to hold off and ruminate on some of the amendments for a little bit, and we will then deal with Senate Bill 1552 and Senate Bills 1564 at our next scheduled meeting. So I appreciate you all sticking in there, and thanks all for your work on these two bills in particular. This meeting is, do I need to roll anything over? I don't think so.
No, we're just going to issue a new agenda.
Yep. And this meeting is adjourned.